Welcome to Minority Corner, where we take an introspective look at the world through an intersectional lens. I'm James, he, him. I'm a queer political activist, actor, comedian, self-proclaimed sexy blurb. That's a black nerd. And each week, I'm joined in the corner by other fabulous minorities and some allies tackling the news, pop culture, politics, media, entertainment, and history with a little self-care, self-love sprinkled throughout, all for our own personal and collective empowerment.
So Beyonce has hijacked this episode because she dropped an interview or an essay, well, whatever it is, full of the queen and her isms, and we must stop the show because we need to discuss, because once again, it is time to bow down, bitches. HBCU, Howard University, is doing something revolutionary when it comes to disparities in health research, especially as when it comes to BIPOC, specifically Black folks, which has led us into a deep dive of HBCUs, what they are, how and why they were started, and why they are still important today. So how are you feeling about our current COVID state of the world? Well, Julia asked the question, specifically thinking about those who are unvaxxed in our lives and how to communicate, how to talk to them. And ultimately, Julia has some insights on how not only talk to and communicate to these folks in our lives, but why just expressing anger and shame is counterproductive, and some solutions of how to talk to folks that we love in our lives about getting vaccinated. All this and so much more on a brand new Minority Corner happening right now. Let's do it.
Hello? Hello, Julia, is that you?
I think I see you over there.
Oh, is that you, Julia? Oh, man, it's been such a long time since we've seen each other. Oh, let's get some lemonade.
Yeah, well, I got a lot to say, and I'm ready to hear it.
Oh, yeah. I don't know why. That was just a little skit we did, listeners. Welcome. And James, this is Julia. For whatever reason, Julia and I, we do old people voices. It's something that we came up with in college, and it just always stuck. I don't know why or where it started from, but you and I will just resort to old angry people on the lawn. I have no idea where it started from or where it came from.
From a place of admiration. I just want to say that.
100%. Yes. I just want all the older people listening to the podcast. Oh, I knew I couldn't trust these people being so young, making fun of me.
You know, imitation, I knew it. The best form of flattery.
So. Best form of flattery. Yeah. Well, I think also, too, it's like we always envisioned ourselves being like, you know, in college, we were rambunctious together, running around, doing our thing, bebopping around. And we just always envisioned that we would see each other again in the old folks' home. Similarly. So it's kind of us projecting our future selves together.
I'm not going to a home.
Okay. Well, that's certainly not one by one. Certainly not run one underneath the tutelage of former Governor Cuomo. He out!
Yikes, yeah.
Boy, bye. Ugh. He's gone. Ooh. Yeah. You know what? Snaps to the Democrats for once again doing the right thing. And the evidence presented itself. Yes. Everybody came around, even Kirsten Gillibrand. Everybody was like, boy, you need to get out. And he did. And way to spike the football before getting to the touchdown zone. Ooh, I almost hit it. I almost said that metaphor correctly. You heard me. Touchdown zone.
I don't know any of these metaphors, so. Yeah, spike, goal, red card, okay.
Hockey puck, okay. Yeah. Slam dunk. A block. Flag on the play. But, like, I just never forget this man. And the pandemic Lovato is still raging. And he, like, gives this whole entire... He writes a book about how I defeated COVID. And, like, in the middle of everything, because he was, like, America's governor, because we had, like, a very lack of leadership. Mm-hmm. And we're still in the middle of it. And then couldn't find out, lied about his numbers for the nursing homes. And then had all these, like, sexual harassment, like, things happening behind in the background. And a friend of my manager, her, like, she's born and raised in New York, and she's like, yeah, the Cuomos have, like, been running New York forever. So it's just time, like, you know, his brother, it helps when your brother's also like a CNN news anchor to help skirt around issues. And you two just get on camera and giggle. And we're just, we're mesmerized by it. You know, we're like, oh, look at those brothers. Just giggling. Meanwhile, old people are dying. Women are being harassed. What?
Yeah.
So we were going to talk about other things. And then in typical Beyonce fashion, she was like, I'm doing something. And the whole world had to stop. What, it was stopped what? Everything. All of the Slack channels at work were just all ablaze. Because Beyonce did an interview.
Yes, she did.
This is huge. This is huge and shocking. And Beyonce, I called you Beyonce. What a compliment. Julia, a.k.a. Beyonce. Why is it, it's, why would you, why is it, it's shocking because she.
Because it's been so long. And, you know, I just think, oh my goodness, I don't even know where to begin with this. I am just having a fever dream over these pictures of her.
Oh, the Harper's Bazaar. Yeah. I mean, it's bananas. Like, the pictures are wonderful. She did an article for Harper's Bazaar and it's, she beyond the reason why the world stopped today. Did she release an album? No. A visual album? No. Is she announcing an album coming? No. Is she going on? None of that. She just did an interview and she doesn't do an interview. She doesn't talk to press.
But,
and so it's wild. It's wild, and we're getting to hear from her.
And also, she is turning 40 soon, so that's kind of a milestone. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
yeah.
I was born a little bit after her, you know, no details.
Okay.
But, you know,
you
I've
know,
always just...
Practically twins.
Practically twins, and she's a Virgo like me, so, you know, always related.
Okay, and there's like there's a quote
about
like never to be forgotten about Virgos in this one. Yes. Like, I think one of the things that I love about this interview, I am going to call it a quote unquote interview. I'm going to say everything that I'm going to say with the caveat of I love Beyonce. So Beehive, like, don't come tweet buzzing at me. But Beyonce is one of those folks that's like, I feel like maybe you feel the same way. I've known her for so long that I feel like I can just be like, oh, that's Keisha from down the street.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so I can also like, I remember her music video when she was like 15 years old with Wyclef Jean. No, 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 no. Let me say, yeah, 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 yeah.
No, 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 no.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, and so Beyonce, and I always have to remind people as I go and like, you know, teaser sometimes, Beyonce was not always Beyonce. Like, it took her, like, her first decade of her being in like the limelight, like, no one was paying attention to her when she was doing Carmen the Hip Opera or,
oh,
like, I was just researching. Like, no one cared. Gold
I
member,
cared.
Nobody cared. Even her-
I kind of cringed at Gold Member, though. I was like, oh, Beyonce can't act. I don't know.
Pink, yes, Pink Panther. Like,
yeah,
she was just doing, like, you know, what you do in those early days, slumming it around,
yeah,
trying to
was,
get, like, a
yeah
check. And she even says in the
mm-hmm
article, she, like, that goes through like her different decades, like when she was 10, 20s, 30s, and 40s. And she said in the 20s, she was just trying to go for like this commercial success. And I was thinking about this too. Throughout the entire article, it's interesting because her and Britney are the same age. And they started very similar around the same time, Britney and Beyonce. And you can kind of see sort of like the pathway and the things that end up happening to Britney and the things and why those didn't happen, you know, to Beyonce, as you like, that kind of stuck out for me as I was reading the article. And it's interesting, like, if you ever watch, do you remember that music video, that Pepsi commercial? It's Brit. Yes, you even know the exact one I'm talking about. What commercial am I talking about?
Generation.
What are we talking about?
Oh wait.
Okay,
Spice
we
Girls?
Were not the,
okay.
That's the Spice Girls. Okay. So do you remember this? That's that. You're right, Julia. That is a Pepsi commercial.
It is a, yes.
Not the one I was thinking. And that was, do you remember that Pepsi commercial? Yes, I do. There is one with the Spice Girls. Yes, that is one. The one that I was actually referencing and thinking about, which is connected to what we're talking about, is the Britney, Beyonce, and Pink Pepsi commercial with Enrique Iglesias, and it's them in the stadium singing We Will Rock You. Do you not remember this one?
I don't remember that one.
Okay, you've got home. Well, during the break, you'll have to take a look at this one. It is epic. And at the time, so it's like Beyonce, Pink, and Britney in the stadium about to fight for, like, you know, the King Roman Empire guy, which is like Enrique Iglesias. And they're like, we're not going to fight. We're going to sing instead. And they get the audience to sing We Will Rock You. It's interesting because this is coming on the heels of, like, Britney was doing all these Pepsi commercials. And she was kind of the lead in that. And it's just so interesting. Like, it was like, oh, Britney. Oh, yeah. And then there's Beyonce and Pink. Like, that's just how interesting that time period is and the time capsule of things. This is like 2003. And it's just interesting because at that time, Britney was the, like, how much Beyonce has totally eclipsed Britney in this, in such a sense. And where with Britney, there was so much access to her. And it damn near destroyed this woman. And whereas Beyonce was like, no, there's no access to me. And then when I do a quote unquote interview, because if you read this quote unquote interview, either Beyonce talks like a book or they emailed her a few questions and they're like, can you answer these? And she wrote an essay. It's more like the essays of Beyonce, right?
She's just very eloquent. I mean, every.
I was like, at first I'm like, this interview. I'm like, wait, no, this is so poetic, like, so well. Like, here's a period. Here's a sentence. Like,
I mean, no, like, talks like we live in a world with few boundaries and a lot of accent. Like, who's that? Who talks like that? I mean, maybe she does. She's.
She could. She very well could. She's
reflecting.
it's so poetic and like just like in the paragraphs. She also talks in paragraphs apparently. But I do like there's but I will say I'm gonna call these the essays of Beyonce. There's so many amazing, great nuggets in here about like health and wellness, taking care of you. I also want to say one of the funny what I love about Beyonce is that she also takes herself very seriously and it is very prevalent in the essays of Beyonce. Like, again, she didn't sit down and do an interview. She's like, tell me what you want, ask me some questions, and I'll write my essay responses to them. so she has this like well thought out. She's not just gonna like, sit and talk to you. Like, she's gonna take some time. But one of my favorites was like, because she's also doing like she's doing like a hemp and honey farm, and so she's like creating all of these like, you know, products and things like that, which I thought was funny that like love it that Beyonce's like, I have beehives on my roof. Like, she literally is Queen Bee with beehives on her roof. And she goes, one of my most, she's talking about like health and wellness and doing it for yourself. And she's like, one of my most satisfying moments as a mom is when I found Blue one day soaking in the bath with her eyes closed, using blends I created, taking time for herself to decompress and be at peace. Her daughter's 9 years old. And I just love this image. She was like, Blue, what you doing? And then Blue is just like with cucumbers on her eyes in this bathway, decompressing. I can't. Of course Beyonce's daughter would need some time to decompress. Because, you know, Blue is probably thinking about some projects and things like that. She's like, the world is stressing me. Mm-hmm. I need some time for me.
Yeah. But I love it because I feel like usually when we think about health and wellness, when we think about yoga, when we think about crystals and things like that, I feel like the image associated 100%. Is usually that of a white woman. And for Beyonce to be taking this up and talking about things like beehives and, you know, all the, say, woo-woo things, I think it's so wonderful because that is a space that I feel like Black women need to see themselves in. They need to see themselves countering these, like, stereotypes and realize that this kind of wellness is accessible and it's not just so lily white and... You know, I feel like it's like normalizing it in a way. And I did see a lot of movements last summer. I joined this yoga training that was specifically targeting Black women because they say, well, when you think about the face of yoga, you think about white women. Ooh. So it's like we want to show that wellness is for everyone. And actually everyone is concerned about their health and nutrition and things like that. It's
And we come from ancestors of healers, too, I would just like to point out. Like, a lot of this actually already came from us, you know, and a lot of even the healing practices are taken from non-white cultures, to quite be completely honest. And then they were told, you can't do those things here. Or, oh, that's not real science. And blah, 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 blah. And now they're like, when I think it was so interesting because, like, I wasn't rolling my eyes at this because it was like, usually it's like Gwyneth Paltrow and her Apple shit or whatnot. And it's just like, ugh, God, but there's something, you're so right. It's so rare that we see these black women getting the limelight and to showcase these things that we already know that they're already doing and as a part of their culture.
Right. And just part the whole, of our like, culture, oh, you know? Such a hippie. Like, I even feel like the word hippie, you know, like when you picture a hippie, what do you picture?
Has like a white connotation to it. Our school, which we'll get into a little bit later. But you're right. Like, it's this connection to like earth and naturalism. I would say there's a lot of non-white cultures that actually have a historic, more connected culture to that.
Right.
Less of like industrialization. And did, you know what really stuck out to me is how much she, just seeing Beyonce of today, because again, I haven't heard her talk in like a long time because she just does not do interviews. And she's crafted herself. She slummed it around doing Pink Panther so she can get to the point where she's like, you're not going to talk to me. And I'm sure she sees the shit that's happening with Britney and being like, glad I did what I did, you know, because we can't handle it. We can't handle celebrity. We don't. We lose our shit. We devour them and then destroy them. And then there's like nothing left. We are the Maenads of ancient Greek. Ooh, but she talks about so much about like black women, womanhood. And she talks about like it was interesting to hear the nuggets of like she was trying to work so hard against like stereotypes of black women. And she'd be in these competitions and she knew that as a black woman at like 9, 7 years old in these singing and dance competitions, that she had to work. Right. She had to be perfect. She had to work twice as hard. Like she had to just be incredibly on point. And then it's interesting too, because she, you see her work ethic. Like at 13, she was singing so much and in recording studios and like, no, I don't like that. Let me hit that again. And to the point where she gave herself, she had to go in vocal rest and go like had nodules, which is something that people usually like much older end up getting because they stress like their vocal cords so much. But she was like, I didn't have time. She's like, I walked away from anything that wasn't going towards my goals. I could not kiki and just hang out. I'm like, okay, Beyonce, go off. And it makes sense. And I then started to think, because part of like, I had a little bit of falling out with Beyonce when she kicked out the other two girls, because I love me some LaToya and LaTavia. And I was not here for Farrah. And I never really accepted. Michelle was like the stepmom who came into my life that I just really never fully accepted, but and made fun of. But she was there. And I'm going to be honest. Maybe this is my own issues, my own stepmother. I don't know. Was this therapy? But
I met Michelle.
Okay. Michelle Williams? Which one?
Yeah.
The black one or the white one? Okay.
The black one. Yes.
I only say that because there was a county fair that was like, Michelle Williams is coming to sing. And they had a picture of white Michelle Williams.
But it wasn't. Oh.
And no one knew. I guess it was. Yeah. No, it was not white Michelle Williams. They were like, Michelle Williams from Destiny's Child. Because back when I was a malicious person, sad with my own life, I would go onto a website called poormichelle.com and I would find these little fun tidbits and, you know, but she, you know, I was young and 28 and, you know, not my best self. But I now think I'm like, oh, you know what? Probably some of these girls were probably not able to keep up with what, you know, Beyonce was like, you know, working. Maybe they wanted to kiki. I also think her dad was probably maybe not, you know, cutting the checks appropriately.
I was going to say.
And she had nothing to do with that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the argument was is that she wrote a lot of the songs and the other girls didn't. So she should be compensated more.
Yes.
I mean, this is just what I read.
That's business. But I'm sure like when you're young and you got other people in your ear and you're like, well, why is she getting these checks? And, you know, and I'm sure I don't know him, but I'm pretty sure Daddy Knowles. But it's a weird situation when you've got your parents involved. I'm sure he was not, you know, the best with business. I want to also like point out something that stuck out to me is that Beyonce edited one of her concerts. I think it was like the I Am World Tour. And she's like, I learned how to edit the cut myself in Final Cut Pro. And it was the beginning of a newfound love. And I'm like, oh my God, go off. Can you just imagine everyone just take a moment and visualize yourself? Visualize Beyonce sitting down at her laptop editing on Final Cut Pro. I love that image. There's something that's just like, me too. I use Final Cut Pro too, Beyonce. Like she's like, oh, I need to cut this shot. And then, you know, she's like, probably like, I don't know how to do this. Let me Google this. And she's like,
just flowing, just function effervescently,
as a
yes.
human being is just so lovely.
I really love the part.
Oh, I'm so frustrated with this. Jay-Z, how do I get this over here? Jay.
I love the part where she talks about her response to quarantine and how she went from overindulgence to creative positive rituals, drawing from past generations and putting her own spin on things. I love that she discovered CBD. I feel like, you know, it still gets kind of a bad rep, but like I use it for soreness and inflammation, and just putting that out there. And that's also where she talks about her honey farm. So I don't know. It's just so.
Yeah. And catching blue ivy, decompressing for her day. I think too, like we've only seen from afar how intentional she's been about cutting herself off from like the media. Again, we can't handle ourselves. Name mm-hmm. any celeb, we've devoured them. We devour Whitney, you're wearing her shirt. We devour, like, we destroy these people. You know, it just, we can't handle it. And I like that she was like, you know, one day I decided I wanted to be like Sade and Prince. I wanted to focus to be on my music, because if my art isn't strong enough or meaningful enough to keep people interested and inspired, then I'm in the wrong business. And see, this is why I'm right. also like, this is an essay. She did not sit down and say this. My music, my films, my art, my message, dash, that should be enough. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then
I feel a renaissance emerging.
Yes. Oh God. And then like all the Virgos are, there's already memes all over the place. She talks about, cause like, you know, she talks about, she's got these parts that are hidden, and she's like, trust, the reason these folks don't see certain things about me is because my Virgo ass don't want them to see it. It's not because it doesn't exist. And so all the Virgos, that's just their theme of their new party.
Yes.
That's it.
My friend posted a great Virgo thing, and it basically said, friends think we're stuck up. Oh, no, sorry. Friends don't think that.
I was like, I don't think that. Okay. Friends think we're stuck up.
Acquaintances.
Okay, there we go. Okay.
Friends hate
Wait,
us.
Wait, what?
They talk behind our backs.
That was one time. And then I told you what I said.
Our friend's name James.
Julia, this is seeming a little personal. I'm off the mic right now. I've stopped recording. Your friend posted that as a meme. So, I would have, oh, my friend.
No. Yeah, she had a picture of you. No.
It's like me getting caught eating cake or something. That's just what my friend, James.
So, acquaintances think we're stuck up. Friends think we're shy. And lovers know we're crazy.
Oh, that sounds right. What was the name of her first solo song?
Yeah.
Crazy in Love.
Crazy in Love, yes.
Oh, yeah. And that crazy theme comes up in a lot of her music. Ring the alarm! Like, there's always something going on. That tracks.
Yeah.
I thought one thing that I also really loved and I wanted to shout out is that, well, first of all, shout out to Aneke, because I told Aneke, I was like, oh, like, Beyonce has an interview just dropped. Like, that's not anything. Beyonce could literally do anything, and she stops the world. So, again, she just had an interview that dropped. And by interview, I mean essay, the Beyonce essays. And Aneke called out. She's like, oh, she must be having either an album or she's promoting her fashion line. And it was the latter, because, like, it's in the middle. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, talk to us about, like, I don't know what it is. This isn't a commercial for her. Y'all know what it is. Blue Ivy, something or other. Right. Anyways, this is not a commercial for her. Figure it out. But I also love that she talks.
I know what it is, but I'm not going to say it.
She's not paying for ad space here. Already giving her enough.
No.
You come on over and you can do that. But she gives, it's a lot of like homage to American Black Cowboys, which I love, because we've talked about it here on the podcast about a lot of their cowboys were Black and Latinx. And so I just love that she's giving this homage to it. Clearly she listens to Minority Corner. I hope she's enjoyed the impressions we've done of her on the podcast, including on this episode. But it's flattery. It's flattery. I just don't know if she has a sense of humor for it, but I don't know. Maybe she does in her sight.
No.
In her
sight.
Love you, we babe. Love you. Don't come after us, Beehive. Don't you do it. Also, too, she suffers from insomnia, and I'm just like, wow, there's just so many things that she's, you know, so human. So I love it. I'm excited for where she's – it's just great to hear from her. And this quote that she said at the very end, our imagination is the only limit to what we can hope to have in the future. And sometimes when I'm really like, I'm like, oh, I'm tired, or I, you know, thinking about my dreams or they're exhausting, I often think, what would Beyonce do? And that's the thing that helps me to like get out of bed or go to the gym or push that extra mile. And then also too, self-caring as well. I think that's also a part of, you know, clearly she's like, takes really good care of herself, and that's all part of it, like you were alluding to. And I just think, like, you know, as much as I tease her and side-eye her, not even side-eye her, I just like to, you know, I have a great love for her, but I also can be like, this article takes itself very seriously.
Well, people should take Black women seriously, James.
You're right. You are right. No, there was humor in this. She was like, y'all just don't see it.
No, yeah.
Y'all just don't see my black ass is being all wild. But also, too, because when you let people in, they can hurt you. Look at what happened to Queen, our other queen bee. She's just a little princess. I just think there's such interesting parallel stories, because it's like, it's literally like one of those like NBC movies, like Switched at Birth, or like movies about twins who go down such similar pathways and then Brittany. Just have such complete crossroads. But one is a gold member, and one was a dream girl, and the other also in gold member. You know, Brittany was also in gold member in the opening dance sequence. Yeah.
She was in the opening.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, all right. On that note, up next, you and I met in college, so we're going to talk about colleges, but specifically black colleges. We didn't meet at a black college, but because we were there, we made it black. We're going to talk about HBCUs. Lifespan Fitness is dedicated to making fitness accessible and affordable. They believe that your office should help you work and feel better with their under-desk treadmills and exercise bikes. Lifespan Fitness's treadmill and bike desks help you make the most out of your workspace, whether you're starting your fitness journey or wanting to stay more active at work. I could not agree more. My previous experience with treadmills in the gym, they're useful, but they're really boring. I just don't have the attention span for it. And y'all know I like to, like our queen Beyonce, maximize my time, self-care, but also take care of myself and my body. And what I love about this is I can do it. I can multitask, help some of those boring meetings go a little bit better. And you might be thinking, how can I possibly walk on a treadmill and work at the same time? You just develop a nice little treadmill etiquette. You know, if I really need to focus on something for a quick second, I step to the side, stop walking. And then when I'm ready to step back on the treadmill, boom, I just start going back at it. If I'm feeling a little bit distracted and unable to focus on work, bump up that treadmill speed just a little bit, just to keep the brain flowing. You know, think about this when you walk, some of your most brilliant ideas come to you. Same thing here. Feeling like you're working up too much heat and are too focused on walking, bump that speed down for a couple of clicks. Gotta run to the bathroom? Well, just step off and head to the bathroom. But so if the treadmill is at 1 mile an hour or more, it'll stop by itself. So you don't have to worry about it wasting energy while you're out there eliminating your own personal, you know, waste. And typically people walk between 0.5 to 2 miles per hour. So, you know, think about how many miles you can log in while you work. Multitask. What would Beyonce do? You already know. So visit lifespanfitness.com and use code MINORITY at checkout for 5% off. That's lifespanfitness.com and code MINORITY.
Video games.
Video games.
Video games. You like them?
Maybe you wish you had more time for them.
Maybe you want to know the best ones to play.
Maybe you want to know what happens to Mario when he dies.
In that case, you should check out Triple Click. It's a podcast about video games.
A podcast about video games? But I don't have time for that.
Sure you do. Once a week, kick back as three video game experts give you everything from critical takes on the hottest new releases,
to scoops, interviews, and explanations about how video games work,
to fascinating and sometimes weird stories about the games we love.
Triple Click is hosted by me, Kirk Hamilton.
Me, Jason Schreier.
And me, Maddie Myers.
You can find Triple Click wherever you get your podcasts and listen at MaximumFun.org.
Bye.
Hitman, boom, ba boom, ba dum, ba dum, boom, boom, ba ba dum, boom, ba dum, ba dum, bam, 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 ba dum, bam, ba dum, boom, bam, bam, ba dum. Horns, stomp it up. Black people everywhere getting our degrees. HBCUs. Everything always needs a theme song. So there we go. Also inspired by Beyonce's Homecoming. Homecoming is a big deal at the HBCUs. So I've seen from afar because I did not attend one. So I want to talk about HBCUs for a moment because there's some really great things that is happening at a specific HBCU. And for those of you who are like, what are these letters that James is saying? Always speak your acronyms. Don't just assume that everybody knows. And HBCUs stand for Historically Black College and University. So it's a place we're going to go into the history of what HBCUs are, but I want to highlight something really amazing happening at Howard University. And so Howard University and several partners are beginning construction in 2023 on a new center dedicated to researching health disparities, which is going to be really key and important that a Black university is going to have a research center focusing on health disparities. And so the aim of the National Research Center of Health Disparities, which will be right next to the School College of Medicine, which I think is a great place to put it, is going to ideally attract pharmaceutical companies and biochemical research organizations that are all focused on treating chronic illness, especially those that affect communities of color. So that's the whole entire thing of like bringing it in here. It's going to be huge, 260,000 square feet. There's going to be a laboratory. Oh, and get this. This article also points out that there's going to be an office building. So they're not messing around. They got laboratories, office building, lots of square feet. So again, if you're thinking about, Julie, if you're thinking about going to get a PhD or something or do some research, you might, you know, think about.
I have been.
Okay, well.
But what is the Watton?
You go on right over there. So COVID shed a lot of light on existing health disparities. And specifically, so Howard University is in D.C., District of Columbia, and Black people make up 46% of the population, but have accounted for 51% of the city's positive coronavirus tests and 76% of total lives lost to COVID-19. And so there must be research into understanding, again, this is just COVID. Who knows all the other mental or physical health ailments that are affecting there's not enough research into it and understanding how our bodies work. Everything is really catered towards white male bodies, and there's not a lot of other research that goes into other kinds of human beings and body types and things like that. And so the vaccination rate, for example, in the ward in DC, which is predominantly Black and low income, it's some of the lowest. And so the research, ideally, because without data, you don't get any funding or legislation or reports. Unfortunately, it's all about the data. Which, sidebar, I want to highlight this about what Beyonce said that I thought was really interesting. When she talks about data, what I love is that, like, because I want to bring this up at work, because everything's all about data. So when she launched I Am Sasha Fierce, which had single ladies, which was her Nexus event, like that was the event that she broke the timeline and she became a household worldwide phenomenon. There's like pre-single ladies and then there's post. And so the data showed that her fans didn't like it when she did black and white photos. And that was the whole entire concept of the music videos, the album. And she was just like, fuck that. Like, she was like, no, like, what is this data? Who are you even interviewing? She's like, fuck you, data and analytics. And she was like, it's always important for her to keep the feeling and spirit and emotion alive in all of her decision making. And sometimes when you just focus on the data and the analytics, what's about the that's a part of it, but it can't be the whole of it. So I just thought that was really fascinating. So tell that to all your data folks of like, data is one thing, but there's got to be the heart and emotion around it. So, but anyways, back to the data. So without data, nothing matters. And so the National Research Center of Health and Disparities is going to be able to make sure that more funding and things like that get presented to these communities, like specifically Black and Brown folks who are being left behind because there's just not enough data and information about it. Okay, so I did want to talk about a brief history of what HBCUs are. So you have that. That's what's going on at a major HBCU, which is really key and important. But what are the history behind these historically Black colleges and universities?
Well, it all goes back into tickety-tock night.
Oh, wait. I have a pop quiz for you, Julia. So, in what year did Washington and Lee University admit John Chavez, who is noted as the first African-American on record to attend college? Was it, I'll give you multiple choice, unless you want to take a guess. Do you want to take a guess or do you want to?
No.
I was like, oh, I know. Yeah.
I was going to guess, okay. But no.
A, 1799. B, 1963. C, 1888. Or D, 2001.
Was it C, 1888?
No. I can see where 1799. Yeah, earlier. I could see why you would think
exactly,
that,
because right.
You're thinking like Civil War right. Hasn't happened. Every racism gonna racist. What white people are gonna let Black people learn, right? But surprisingly, in 1799, John Chavez, the first African American on record, there could have been. They did not take track of our history in our notes. So it's the first one on record.
Wow.
I bet you there's probably some Black woman who was like, you know. Charlene Chavez was like, excuse me, what about me? They're like, we can't write your name down, you woman. So who knows? I could be making
that's
a history,
really impressive. I mean,
1799.
Wow.
Could you imagine?
No.
We thought going to UC Santa Cruz and being like one of the handful of Black people was hard. Could you imagine? I can only imagine the teachers were just really not helping the professors,
mm-mm.
like throwing his books in the mud and being like, read these muddy books and your papers due 2 hours ago. And he still passed. However, though, the first African-American to have earned a bachelor's degree was from an American university, Alexander Lucius Twilight. He graduated from Middlebury College in 1823. So this is why Middlebury College tends to be considered one of just like the, well, I don't know if that's true. But 3 decades later, Mary Jane Patterson, was the first African-American woman to earn a bachelor's degree, graduating from the abolitionist-centered Oberlin College in 1862. And so these individuals were singular in helping to access higher education and blowing down the walls. And you, again, before the Civil War, and this is why you were thinking like, ain't no Black person get no degree before
right.
the Civil War until, you know, we have to have a war so we can go learn some stuff. But to that point is that before the abolition of slavery in 1865, there was anti-literacy laws that prevented enslaved and free Black people from obtaining education because they're like, if they read, they're going to realize that this is fucked up what's happening. It's like, oh, it says it in this book. I could read this pamphlet.
Right.
That should not be in these chains. just afraid of, again, always goes back to afraid of education, which is why they're dumbing our children down.
Suspended. You suspended for being Black.
Yes.
Yeah.
You can still to this day. So seeing a need for opportunity for reform, Quaker philanthropist Richard Humphreys snapped at the Quakers.
Wow.
Oh, wait, they were down. The Quakers were always like, let's fix this. Like, using religion the right way, I would say. You know? Like, how can I create good and make some bomb-ass oatmeal for, like, you know, the world? And wear this cute little hat. I love me some Quakers. Like, I'm like, if I had to go back in time, I would find me, if I, like, fell into some portal and I was whisked away back in time into like the 1800s, I would find the nearest Quaker as fast as I could and I feel safer. Yeah. You know, they were like the real, like, you know, you want to find, like, you know, when we talk about allies, like, you don't want just like, you don't want someone who's like, oh, I'm not racist. You want an anti-racist right. person. Like Quakers, like, you weren't just like, so you don't want someone who's like, oh, I don't like slavery, I think it's bad. You want a fucking abolitionist. Mm-hmm. Someone who's like, I'm gonna blow this shit up with you, Chauncey. I was gonna name him. Charlene. So he founded the Institute for Colored Youth in Cheyenne, Pennsylvania, which again eventually became Cheyenne University. So this is one of the first HBCUs that ended up getting founded. That was in 1837. So this is the oldest HBCU in the United States, is Cheyenne. And this became a place for formerly enslaved folks to learn reading and writing and basic math and religion and industrial arts. They could essentially just have a life and be a part of society and create for their own. And then during the 1850s, three more HBCUs were founded. Minor Normal School. I don't know about that name, you guys, but okay.
I'm a little normal.
Made sense inside someone's last name. Minor Normal School.
Minor Normal.
We can make fun of this.
I didn't major in normal. I only minor.
Where'd you go? Crazy. Minor Normal School. Minor than. Oh, is that Beyonce? You Virgo over there. Okay.
Minor than normal.
Madder than normal.
Madder than
Major than crazy. That's her new song she's working on. Major than crazy. Crazy in degrees, because she's a businesswoman. And then we had Lincoln University, which my cousin went to in 1854 in Pennsylvania. And then Wilberforce in 1856, which that sounds like the dopest university ever. Wilberforce. Like, it just, I want to buy the toys. I want to see the movie. And then there was the African Methodist Episcopal Church, which established Wilberforce University. And that was the first HBCU operated by Black folks. So that is huge. Wilberforce.
Wow.
So then after the Civil War, so this is where you come into play, Julia. I'm just going back to where your mindset was.
The HBCUs. Yes, I was born.
Oh, yes.
After the war.
The HBCUs emerged to provide Black Americans with just basic human rights, which was access to full education and a bathroom and a drinking water. But before the Civil War, it was, again, pretty much illegal for Southern states, and it was discouraged in the North. And so, you know, Black folks really could not attend universities, probably shrouded. There's so much racism. Probably if you were even to go to a white institution, it would just be a lot. So from 1865 to 1900s, you have the largest amount of HBCUs that get started. Essentially, in 1867, you had the most amount that got started 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. Tons of them. Morehouse College, Morgan State University, Alabama State University, just tons and tons and tons. John C. Smith University, Talladega, the list goes on. And then in 1890, there was the Second Morrill Act. And what that said is that it specified that states using federal higher education funds must provide an education to Black students, either by opening the doors of their public university to African Americans or by establishing schools specifically to serve them. So you can only imagine, which route do you think some of these white places decided to go? So you're saying we either have to let Black people in here or create entire universities for them, separate from us? Yeah.
Probably that.
Yep. That's why you have so many also in the South.
Wow.
That's why you have so many HBCUs in the South. So, like, literally white people would rather be like, no, you all go over here. So many Southern states created separate institutions for them. But at the same time, listen, Black folks were thriving in these places. Like, that's just what we do. Like, we made, you know, magic out of these. And Black colleges, they thrived. And throughout the 20th century, you just had some of the biggest and brightest, you know, metal sharpens metal. You just have Black people from all over the place coming here and being fabulous. So I want to highlight this. So technically HBCUs are those that are created before 1964. Any other college after that was created is actually technically called a PBI, which is a predominantly Black institution. And so PBIs are defined as anything that any university that has 40% undergraduates who are Black and at least 1,000 undergraduates and 50% are lower income or first generation degree, which is the same stipulations as the HBCUs. I think it just means they just don't get to call themselves historically. They're just like, oh, you just Black. You're not historically okay. Black. You're just, oh, we Black.
Right.
That's just it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then approximately 89% of all HBCUs are in the South, which I did not know. Well, that makes sense. We're talking about 89%. There are some.
I mean, yeah.
That makes sense. There are some found in Delaware, Illinois. Illinois, with all their sundown towns they had, not surprised. Maryland, mm-hmm. Maryland, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia. And North Carolina hosts 11 HBCUs. Louisiana has 7, and Alabama has 12. Makes sense. Black people are like, I can't go to school here. I gotta create my own. And those numbers
are there any on the West Coast?
There's not, which I think that I'm going to put that as that's why we didn't go to an HBC. If there was one in California, I would have, I would have gone. I would say, I could ask you, I was going to wait till the end. I think someone asked me this recently. They said, if you had to do it all over again, would you go to an HBCU? And I said, absolutely yes. If I know what 36-year-old James knows now and had to go to university all over again, and then I would take you and Aneke with me.
Yeah. I would do it, yeah. And I remember my mom tried, and I was like, oh, no, I'm not going to have anything in common. I like Alanis Morissette.
And you know what? You then would meet your Black best friend who also listens to Alanis Morissette. Like, I think that's interesting because if this goes into later as, like, you know, some of the people are like, oh, why do we even still need HBCUs? And I think that the Black diaspora is so, people are like, oh, it's so homogenous. The Black diaspora is so huge. There's just so much diversity within the Black community as there is. And I think I had the same sort of feelings like, oh, would I be accepted? Or, you know, I didn't know I was gay when I first, you know, went into college, but, you know, I was so accepted at UC Santa Cruz. I would have been accepted by like queer Black people. I would have like found that there at that university. And we could be. And also, too, just the Black networks that you make at the HBCUs.
Oh, man.
We'd be judges. Who knows what we would be? Like, we'd be vice president.
I know. I would have been AKA straight to the top.
Yes. Squee-wee. Like, part of the Divine Nine. Like, man.
Oh, what could have been?
What could have been? Oh, man. Did not have that at UC Santa Cruz, which was a PWI. Predominantly white institution, which I did not realize I went to until I went to a conference and they're like, oh yeah, those PWIs. I'm like, oh yeah, those PWIs. And then I was like, oh, that's, oh, I go to that. Oh, no. So you might be asking, wait, I'm not Black. Can I go to an HBCU? Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Like, you absolutely can. In 2018, non-Black students made up 24% of enrollment. And compared to 15% in 1976. So even in 1976, like, if you watch A Different World, which that's how I learned about HBCUs, there was always those down and out, like, you know, white people there. And in fact, like, you are invited to the cookout forever. Like, I love whoever you are. White person at an HBCU, like, you doing it. Yay you. Yay you. Unless you're Rachel Dolezal, you get out of there.
So good, yes.
the difference between Rachel Dolezal going to an HBCU is she's going there and saying, I'm a Black woman, as opposed to just being like, I'm a white woman going to an HBCU. That's just, that's what we, you can go, just be you, don't.
Yeah, just be you, I mean.
Be
just...
you, Rachel.
I just love Black D. No, I'm
okay. Oh, this is the rated. Ooh, we must be getting late.
Uh-oh.
So from the late 1800s to the late 1900s, like I said, they thrived. HBCUs provided undergrad training for 75% of all Black Americans holding a doctorate degree, 75% of all Black officers in the armed forces, and 80% of all Black federal judges. We would have been judges. Like, they still to this day make up a really great impact of folks who are able to go out and be successful because, you know, yes, like racism is still going to racism. And so there's extra hurdles that non-white students in particular have to deal with when they go to university. I remember, I'll never forget this. And this is the same for even companies, is that I will remember this when I, you know, you and I both did a lot of stuff with like orientation and being leaders on campus and orientation leaders and RAs and stuff like that. And one of the biggest hurdles, like, it's not enough to get non-white students to your university. You have to keep them there. Retention is really key. And so even for companies and businesses who are recruiting for, you know, trying to diversify their candidate pool or their employees, but what do you have to provide specifically for these groups of people? Which is why things like affinity groups or employee resource groups are really important. Oaks College, I at least would have went to Oaks College if I was going to go back to UCSD. But then I wouldn't have met you, and that, you know, no regrets. But I wish I wouldn't have been as terrified and afraid and feeling like I wasn't welcomed within my own Black identity and community, and realizing I would help make it what it is.
100% ditto. I was afraid. I didn't go to Oaks. My mom was like, go to Oaks at least if you're not going to go to Spelman. I was like, no. it's just so sad, you know?
You know what? I have a theory of what it is. Here's my theory. I think that there's so... Because when I went to New York, that's when I was really blown open of like how diverse the Black diaspora is. I actually think the West Coast Black diaspora is very kind of limited a little bit. I think that it's, and maybe that's, and this is my theory that I'm thinking out loud, maybe that's why we didn't feel like we had connected and felt into it, because it's a very specific sort of either stereotype or archetype that we, for one, saw through media, two, then got perpetuated in school, whereas in New York, you just have Black people coming from all different places. There's more diversity, I think, in economic statuses as well. There's so much other culture and community, whereas like I feel like a lot of the Black folks in the West are folks who pretty much fled from the South or the Midwest, whereas you get more folks who are maybe coming from Europe or even, you know, the Caribbean more directly. Just my theory.
I think a lot of it is that California is so big. So, yeah. I mean, I was down in little Santa Paula, you know, minding my own business. But I mean, because of Zoom and going to college and things like that, I've met other, you know, Black Californians who talk like me, who, you know, have a...
We just were so spread out.
We were like, so spread out.
And me, I was all the way up in Fairfield, California.
I know.
Where's that, Julia?
Yeah, so if you're out there somewhere, some little town in California,
reach out and apply to go to an HBCU. You will.
Yeah, you probably should.
I mean, yes, some of these universities need the numbers, but that's not your job. If you have that in your heart, I just, you know, yeah. Uncle James and Aunt Julia are saying, you go to that college.
Don't be afraid. You're going to meet people who what do white kids listen to?
Zane? Zane is the thing I've heard them say.
I don't know what that means.
Is Zane a thing? Zane? I think he's a pop.
Oh, well, One Direction? Is
Selena Go. Yes, yes. Selena. Well, she's Latina. Yeah. Billie Eilish.
Yeah, I didn't want to say. I was like, is she still happening? Billie Eilish, there you go. If that's your thing.
Yes, someone.
You have green hair. Yes. You'll
find your people. Okay, so just wanted to, this is going on, sorry, it's going for so long. I'm not going to apologize for talking about HBCUs as I'm doing an advertisement pamphlet for this. Y'all need to hear this. So HBCUs have survived Jim Crow and just the Ku Klux Klan and racism. Right now, they're in trouble because of inadequate like funding. Some of them are being forced to close today. Accreditation issues. The pandemic, again, disparities, it's just going to make things even worse for some with enrollment and funding. And so currently today, HBCUs represent 2.3% of the total amount of undergraduate schools. So there's about 101 institutions. Sidebar, there are also Native American tribal institutions, which are about, there's 17 in total, and that's about 0.3%. 0.95% of all the institutions. But they still serve, HBCUs still serve as this refuge to for folks to dive deeper into their cultural heritage in a psychologically safe space without fear of discrimination. And so they are still key, still important. Today, only about 8% of Black college students attend an HBCU, but apparently enrollment has actually increased slightly since 2000 by about 10%. And you're just actually seeing more Black folks even just enter into the university system. It's increased about 80%. Yeah, it's we're so that was a nice figure. Isn't that nice to hear something positive about Black increase?
Yeah, that's huge. Yeah,
80% in that same time period, which is like, that's huge. And so now demographics of HBCUs are also changing. So it used to be like middle class and highly prepared folks, but now it's actually lower income and not as prepared. So unfortunately, it can affect graduation rate. So what ends up happening is, you know, low income, first generation or underprepared folks just tend to be failed by their previous schools and institutions, and they get into school, and then it's this vicious cycle because they end up not graduating, and lower graduation rates, then governments tend to not continue funding those as much, or even investors, or then it decreases your alumni pool, and it just, and then these HBCUs also have inferior facilities, underpaid faculty. It's just, and this is the heartbreaking thing. These things are such important institutions to not only the Black community, but the fabric of America. We need these HBCUs to continue. Again, it helps with equity because these students are going to have a more fair educational experience for these students, you know, who choose to go there. And like, we're going to, you know, get some of these more Kamala Harris's coming out of there, you know, the next Martin Luther King Jr. pumping out over there, you know. Michelle Obama, I mean, Oprah, I don't know if she went, I think she was on a list. And so in, she was on this article list. I don't know that Oprah went to university. I feel like I should know this. I don't, she never talks about it, but she does love school and education. She's a lifelong learner for life, you know. But I'm pretty sure she at least has like an honorary doctorate from some, I mean, that I think.
I don't know. I know.
Every, right. Actually, I think she has 101. One from each one of the HBCUs. Yeah. 102. Spelman gave her two.
Oh, for sure. She probably has 12.
So, I mean. So these HBCUs, they produce about 24% of Black STEM grads, and almost 35% of all bachelor degrees earned by Black graduates in astronomy, biology, chemistry, math, and physics. And according to a report from the National Science Foundation, 8 of the top 10 institutions, including Black undergrads, went on to earn science and engineering doctorates were HBCUs. So it's all, so all that to say, again, going back to like Howard University, it's just amazing to see that Howard University is launching this new, you know, research facility that I hope will generate more interest, more income, and more success. If you're like, what can I do? Well, donate to an HBCU, become a funder. You can, that's a great place to start. These are absolutely incredibly important. In 2009, the average endowment for HBCUs was $49.3 million, compared to 87.7% million at public schools in general. And for private colleges, the HBCU endowment was $38 million, compared to $223 million for the sector as a whole. Which makes sense because, again, if Black people are also getting paid less, like, it's all just a trickle effect. And, like, if the alumni is getting smaller and the alumni is not getting paid as much as, like, white folks. So all that to say, go off Howard University. I want to just give some love to HBCUs, where they came from, some of their history, and to celebrate Howard University, who's still going strong. It's a different world. Woo! And where you come from. Woo! If quality and craftsmanship is important to you, you should check out Made In. Made In is a cookware and kitchenware brand that works with renowned chefs and artisans to produce some of the world's best pots, pans, knives, and wine glasses.
Made In sources the finest materials and partners with renowned craftsmen to make premium kitchen tools available directly to you without those markup prices. This is really great. I was looking for some really nice wine glasses. I like to impress, but I just don't like shelving out lots and lots of money for just wine glasses. But at the same time, you know what? You get what you pay for. And I felt like Made In was the right happy medium space for me, which is so perfect having the one or two occasional guests in these times over to sip a bottle of rosé and my new Made-In glasses. And I feel like I'm impressing my friends. So if you too would like to impress your friends, and they have all kinds of other stuff, they've got cookware, they've got knives, so you can really just upgrade your kitchen set and be the bomb-ass human being that you are. Plus, they have over 32,000 five-star reviews, and their products are used by some of the world's best chefs at Michelin-starred restaurants. So they got the receipts. Right now, Made In is offering our listeners 15% off your first order with promo code MINORITY. This is the best discount available anywhere online for Made In products right here on Minority Corner, so all for you. Go to madeincookware.com/minority and use promo code MINORITY for 15% off your first order. Once again, that's madeincookware.com/minority. Use promo code MINORITY.
Hey everyone, it's I, John Hodgman of the Judge John Hodgman podcast.
And I, Elliot Kalin of the Flophouse podcast.
And we've made a whole new podcast, a 12-episode special mini-series called iPodius, in which we recap, discuss, and explore the very famous 1976 BBC miniseries about ancient Rome called I, Claudius. We've got incredible guests such as Gillian Jacobs, Paul F. Tompkins, as well as star of I, Claudius, Sir Patrick Stewart. And his son, non-Sir Daniel Stewart.
Don't worry, Dan, you'll get there someday.
iPodius is the name of the show. Every week from MaximumFun.org for only 12 weeks. Get them at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, coming straight out of the University of Whitney, it's Professor Julia Hardy.
Hey, 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 everyone. So, I get so emotional, baby. I am okay. Speaking of emotions, I wanted to ask you.
It's not right, but you know what, Julia? It is okay.
It is okay.
You're going to take me to the Heartbreak Hotel.
So, I want to.
Because I just want to dance with somebody. I could be here all day. Sorry.
I get so emotional historically, and that has been something that I have been, you know, working on and doing self-care. But I wanted to start off by asking you, James, how are you feeling about where we are with the Rona, with the Delta variant?
Yes, with the Delta variant, the pandemic lovato that's going on, the Ponderosa. It's disheartening. I've had to cancel. I plan work events, and we had started planning these about 2 months ago because things looked optimistic. I was actually supposed to be in Austin, Texas right now, which that got canceled because Austin is in stage 5 with still no mask mandate.
Yeah.
I'm disheartened because I actually was very skeptical that we would be reopening. I didn't think we would have the summer. I feel like summer was promised. Back when I was vaccinated back in April, and they were like, oh, we're going to open up in June. I was very hesitant. But then I got a taste of it, and things looked like they were going really well. And so now I'm getting – it's almost like this deja vu triggering experience. I do know that as a vaccinated person, I am – like, the likelihood of me going into the hospital if I were to contract COVID is very, very low. Being vaccinated is so much more – better obviously than not, so I feel, you know, safe in that like, you know, I went to the club and wore a mask and stayed social distancing as I listened to like my DJ set, and it wasn't a lot of people there, which is why I felt safe going, but I wore a mask, or, you know, I'm still engaging in safe behavior. And so some of the fear I'm having to realize is some of the experience and trauma of what I went through before. But all in all, I'm disappointed, and I wish everybody would just get fucking vaccinated.
Is that okay to say? That's right.
That is okay. This is a safe space. This is a safe space.
Okay, great.
So, I mean, yes, I have been noticing, and that's what I wanted to talk about, a lot of articles and just me starting to re-engage with social media, a lot of posts that are really vilifying the unvaccinated. And just a little statistics, there are 93 million eligible people who have declined to be vaccinated. And so that's about 30% of the population who is eligible for the vaccine. And as of today, you know,
when you say eligible, is this just by age, or is it also, cause I know there's some people for medical reasons that they can't. And so
this is by age.
No qualms like with that experience. Mm-hmm. So they're factored into that. So there could be another slight factor. It's like, oh, but what are those 30% people can't get it because of health reasons?
Yes, and that's something that's important to consider, because a lot of what is being put out there are just sort of lumping together the unvaccinated, saying that they are, you know, stupid spreaders.
Anti-vaxxers.
Yes, anti-vaxxers, stupid spreaders, that they're ignorant, that they're bodunks, that they're, you know, rednecks. And just like reading all of this stuff, I'm like, hey, wait a minute. Can we dive a little deeper into this? And can we start looking at maybe some of the statistics?
I think something that you brought up that I thought was really interesting is that there is a difference between there's also like anti-vaxxers and then people who are not going to get this vaccine,
right?
You know, like they're not the same necessarily, but
Yeah, and a lot of people are skeptical for reasons that maybe we might not think are super valid, but I think a lot of people are waiting for the FDA to approve one of the vaccines, and I know that they say the Kaiser vaccine should be approved by the FDA within the next few weeks. So
some are skeptical for reasons, like I understand black skepticism around it. I absolutely do not, like, especially if you grew up like with Nixon.
Exactly.
It's just like you have a mistrust of the government. If Nixon was like, you know, there's just a lot of scandalous shit that was happening. You know, and Tuskegee, but I will say, like, I've had this conversation with my dad of like, that's not necessarily this. And I think that there's a lot of like fear and I think people are scared. And when people are scared,
yes,
things get bananas.
And that brings me to my quote by the sage Yoda. Fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering. So that was one of the gems from one of the early Star Wars movies, and I think it's very applicable today. And
episode one,
mom,
the one
it
crown
was episode
jewel
one.
From episode one, which is wild.
But that
is such a highly quoted quote from Star Wars, and it's from episode one, y'all. So calm down, everybody. You know, maybe there's gems in everything. There's gems in everything. Find the golden nuggets, okay?
Yes. So you were talking about your dad. My mom is not vaccinated, and, you know, it's something that I've been asking her about ever since the vaccines came out. And, you know, just a little background, you know, she is a doctor. She graduated she graduated top of her class. You know, she was in, she went to SF University, and she
okay,
was
okay, she didn't go to HBCU.
No, she didn't.
But that's probably why she wanted you to
then
go. She wanted you to go because she was like, I didn't go, so you go.
No, and so as a black female doctor in the 70s and 80s, can you imagine? I am not at all surprised that she has kind of turned her back on Western medicine. You know, she encountered so much racism, so much sexism. She was around during the AIDS epidemic and saw so much death. She was in San Francisco.
And that was a pandemic and that literally the government turned its back on a specific group of people.
Exactly. And so that is why I feel like it's important for us to, instead of focusing on these individuals and lumping them all together and just writing them off as stupid, what is the role of the government? What is the role of the CDC? What is the role of pharmaceutical companies, you know, because that was a huge thing with the AIDS epidemic, is just like having all of these privatized solutions. And it wasn't until, you know, people were like literally dropping bodies on doorsteps and, you know, getting more, unfortunately, media attention. And until it started affecting more, you know, honestly, white people.
Yep.
That people started taking it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So, but of course, you know, these things are very different. And this is not something that discriminates as far as, you know, sexual orientation, as far as gender identity, as far
as race.
It affects
straight, rich, white men as well, which is why we've had, like, oh, there's a vaccine. Like, it, if it was, like, there, I think that's made a huge, huge difference, which is why I also use the caveat to my fellow, you know, black folks who are like, oh, I don't know. I'm like, listen, rich white people are taking this vaccine, which is why I'm like, if it's good enough for them, you know.
So this is something that I wanted to talk about just because I have been reading so much just toxicity and so much just hate and anger towards the unvaccinated population. And, you know, I'm just going to say I am vaccinated, you know. we had to, last week actually at work, they were trying to get us to, like, do a little video conference to show our card. And I was like one of the first people, like, here it is, I'm vaccinated. But, you know, I'm also experiencing, you know, my mom and my partner actually works at a county hospital, and some of the people he works with are not vaccinated. And these are healthcare professionals. And some of them, you know, feel very strongly saying, oh, well, some of the reasons I've heard is, oh, well, I had COVID, so I have the antibodies. And one of the responses that I have is, well, you know, those antibodies might not last as long as you think they will. And,
true.
Yeah, and just, I mean, the most that I've heard and read and listened to is a lot of distrust for the government. So,
which my mom was saying, though, too, is that I think, like, when things started off, she, because she has some people, my mom's vaccinated, but she was saying how, like, when this all started, there was such misinformation. And so I think it put people in a very sort of, I don't know what to trust sort of situation. You know, I think if we would have had a stronger government stance, I do wonder if, like, I wonder about this, if Trump had been reelected and the vaccine was fully came out underneath his watch, would I actually have had more skepticism about getting it? I'm curious. I'd like to have faith and hope that I would listen to the science, see there's a black woman who was involved with the creation of the vaccine. And I think I maybe wouldn't have gotten it in, like, April, May, but I think I would eventually, like, come around and seen the science. I think I would have. I'd like to hope.
Right.
You know, there's so much, we don't know the long-term effects of, like, the vaccine. True, we do know one of the short-term effects from COVID is death. Just throwing that out there. And they're like, oh, I don't want to be a guinea pig. But we also are then using, we don't know long-term effects from this from children. I just always think, like, I don't understand how we can't think about the children. We don't know the long-term effects of this or how it's all going to affect for the children. And so I wish we could just do things for the kids, like also get rid of guns. But, you know, we don't know how to save the children. We can't. There's a whole entire organization to save the children.
When I am, you know, talking to someone who is unvaccinated, that I think is like one of the big selling points, is that you need to include children in the discussion. Because when you think, oh, the unvaccinated, they're just, you know, fools, conspiracy theorists, like they're injecting microchips in our arms. And it's like, what
going
about
to spring break.
The kids? And we are seeing, like, how, you know, this is becoming so politicized, and kids are kind of just being, like, used in the fodder. Yeah, exactly. And
the political football.
Exactly. And so, you know, there are a number of red states who are basically banning mask mandates.
DeSantis, Florida.
Which, Yes, which I'm like, banning a man, I don't know.
It's like, how dare you try to protect these children? Like, making it illegal for you to say, hey, these kids, that is bananas, this thing that would save everybody.
Right.
It'd be like saying, like, oh, we've had too many car accidents, we're going to make it so people, you know, we want them to wear seatbelts. It's illegal to wear a seatbelt. You need to drive down the highway. And you're like, oh, we're going to make a speed limit. No, it is illegal. We're Americans. We have our right to drive as fast as we want without a seatbelt. Like, no, you're putting your life in danger and the life of other people in danger. I feel like that's that thing when you're saying, what is the role of government? I feel like I'm piecing something together.
Exactly. What is the role of government? And perhaps that is what we should be targeting some of our anger towards, rather than spewing it all on Twitter or whatever your little platform is.
Snapchat.
You know, trying to shame grandpa who's just, you know,
reading his conspiracy theory blogs or vlogs or vines. Grandpa's on the vine again.
Yeah, exactly. So it is the people in these positions of power who are making these mandates, and instead of attacking, you know, so-and-so or so-and-so, perhaps we should direct that anger towards, you know, advocacy for change, towards writing letters to congressmen, mm-hmm. towards, you know, volunteering. There is a wonderful website.
I'm going to play Polly Sue Advocate, or I don't know, like, I don't want to invoke the devil in here. I'm going to play other person. But Julia, that sounds like so much work, and it's easier for me just to go online and yell at grandpa and do like a post and tag him in it. That's work.
Well,
mm-hmm.
yeah. Let me ask you, Polly Sue.
Yes.
What do you get out of posting such horrible things to your grandpa?
Oh, I stick it to him, and I get immediate gratification, and I get all these likes, and I speak his mind. And then grandpa tries to send something to me, sends me an article. I spring it right back. Don't play with me, old fool.
And do you feel that you feel good later on, like maybe the next day?
I feel terrible. I feel awful. I then eat a bunch of ice cream and I cry into my pillow. And then I can't stop thinking about what he wrote. And I'm like, I'm not going to look. And then I look, and then he said something, and then I write something back. And then I'm like, oh, I'm not going to do anything else. And then it just keeps going. And I got fired from work because
exactly.
I did was
and
clap back at my
think
grandpa.
Maybe instead of using that anger to bully your grandpa, you might have used it to maybe turn your attention to helping out with the cause, to volunteering, to joining a mailing list, to writing to the people who are limiting these mandates, and going to a mobile vaccine clinic, and just helping getting the word out rather than attacking your grandpa.
That's so much work. And I actually am writing, Miss Professor Hardy. I've been writing my Bridgerton fan fiction, where they're all vampires and werewolves. It's not Twilight. End scene.
Yes, mm-hmm. End scene. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, one of the suggestions, and if we can look at other countries, we can look at France. So, France started to require a mandate where you have to show proof of vaccination if you want to go into public spaces, restaurants, things like that. The next day, like over 2 million people signed up to get vaccinated. So it's really kind of like a carrot and stick thing. And we are starting to see more
of these.
There's
no consequences.
Exactly.
People go the speed limit because they're like, well, most people, majority of people go the speed limit or stay within the realm of it because they're like, there's consequences for not being able to participate in different areas of life.
Yes, exactly. And the CDC has a lot of guidelines for talking to people who are...
Suggestions. Every time the CDC comes out with guidelines, I'm like, these are suggestions, it feels like. It always feels very like, you could do this. But we're not going to tell you what to do because you won't be mad at us.
And it's just so important to have empathetic, thoughtful listening conversations. If you need to take a pause, if you need to take a break, and also know, you know, you can't change the world around you, but you know what you can do? Change the one inside you.
Well, that is the episode. So much to unpack. It's always so good to have Julia on. We do have a minor fact check. It looks like, remember all that talk about DaBaby last week and that he had released an apology statement to the LGBTQ plus community? Well, he issued a second apology in a single Instagram post and then deleted it. It's a mess. He's still a mess. And here we are. Well, on that note, I do want to just thank our wonderful editor and producer, Sarah Brown, and production coordinator, Lori Fowler, and all of our wonderful listeners and Maximum Fun subscribers. We can't do the show without you. So thank you all so much. And listening to the tail end, look at you getting all this good at the very end. Up, if you stop before this, you're missing all this jazz. And thank you to Beyonce, because I feel like you should always thank Beyonce. All right, well, that's going to do it. Have a wonderful, fabulous week, and we'll catch you next week. Thank you for listening to Minority Corner, because together, we're the majority. Stay healthy, be well, love yourself, and love everybody else around you.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.